Charlie. You have got to control this thing because it's a bad thing. You understand me? A bad thing.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Firestarter Retrospective Series.
I'm a little nervous about this, Andy McGee.
Join Garrett.
Don't you ever bathe, weirdo?
Matt.
Micro hemorrhages, his brain bleeds when he uses his power.
And Adam.
I want to do that again!
As they review all of the adaptations of author Stephen King's 1980 novel.
Honest to gosh, there's nothing going on here except...
We know what's going on.
Please don't make me do anything!
And keep coming back, as periodically the boys will continue to review each Stephen King adaptation in publication order.
Is this experiment being done by the shop?
No. Absolutely not.
So heat up, percolated media listeners.
Come on, I want to see you, son of a bitch!
The Three Men in a Retrospective Firestarter series begins now.
So, if we may begin the injections now, please.
Firestarter, released May 11th, 1984. Budget on this was $12 million. Box office, $17.1 million. And this is directed by Mark L. Lester. Firestarter was 1984, right after a big swing of King films had come out. We talked about The Dead Zone last week. This one was published a year after The Dead Zone. It was the first book that King wrote in the 80s. Adam, I have to ask right off the bat, considering we just got through speaking about Marvel a couple weeks ago, this has to prove more than anything that King is a Marvel fan, right?
Why? Because he gave us freaking X-Men universe here with this film?
Yes.
I think he at least delves in that. I would not be surprised that he grew up and being the nerdy guy that he was, just reading some of the stuff that would inform his work, especially when you look at Bullies and Telekinesis and so many, let's call them repeating themes, if I'm going to be gentle. Yeah, I think absolutely.
Matt, did you get that sense?
If nothing else, he loves telepathy and sort of what the mind is capable of. Because I also think this reminded me a lot in a lot of ways of The Lawnmower Man.
Oh, wow. You went Lawnmower Man? See, I went Carrie with this.
Well, that's the obvious place.
That's obvious, yeah.
With the shop and the tapping into people's hidden potential, that made me think of The Lawnmower Man. And that means both the good and the bad.
All right. Well, the making of this is curious. We have Dino De Laurentiis back. He's producing this. And he had hired somebody to write and direct this, guy by the name of John Carpenter. He had worked on it.
Yay!
Him and his partner, who would write Christine after he was booted off this project. They were hired. They were working on it for a set of months. And then the thing came out. And Dino was like, you know what? I don't want him to do my movie because he took this thing and he made a box office bomb. So he kicked John Carpenter off the project. Yet it's very weird that we are talking John Carpenter because we'll be talking about him again in a couple weeks when we get to the remake.
And Christine.
And Christine, yep, at least a year down the road. But, Matt, you look at this movie, do you think John Carpenter could have done something with this?
Certainly more than the guy who made Commando, which, look, I love that movie, but he's not a David Cronenberg or a John Carpenter where he has a very particular style that can kind of take the template and mold it into something special. You can tell this is the first one in a while where they didn't have a quote-unquote auteur because Lester doesn't bring a particular style. I mean, you could have swapped out Mark Lester for Richard Lester and it probably would have been the same damn movie.
Wow. Look, he had done a little movie called Class of 1984. Apparently Dino saw that and liked it and brought him on. And what Lester did was he brought his buddy that he did that movie with, Stanley Mann, to do a script of it. He brings it to Dino and Dino looks at the script and he goes, you guys just wrote the book. This is the book. What are you doing? Like, there's nothing here. And Lester's excuse for it, Lester's explanation was, how much did you pay for the book? And Dino was like, well, I paid $1 million for it. He goes, why not get your money's worth out of it? Boys, no matter what we have to say about this movie, I'm going to say right now, as somebody who has read the book, read it fairly recently, this is a about as loyal an adaptation as you're going to see, because there are lines directly from the book in this movie. There are scenes directly from the book in this movie. Matt, this is somebody taking the script and not even doing any interpretation.
Well, I'll take your word for it because I haven't read the book, so I can't speak on that front. But there's something about the dialogue in particular that feels like it's lifted from a book. I can't quantify exactly why, but I also remember, because I did some digging, Burt Lancaster's kid wrote this when Carpenter was attached.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they threw that script out with John Carpenter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they completely threw it out.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Yeah, the guy who wrote The Omen 2, and he didn't write Conan the Barbarian, he wrote Conan the Destroyer.
Yes. Speaking of which, Stephen King, he had read this script. He sent a note to Stanley Mann saying, this is the best adaptation of anything I've ever read.
Because it ceased to be an adaptation, apparently, and it was just a translation.
Exactly, it's a translation. He had really good things to say about it in the lead up to it. He had visited the set a number of times. He was on set for a lot of this. And then the movie came out. And funny thing about King, around this time, he had a pretty decent amount of power. I think at this point, King had gotten to where the movies had given him points. And he took a percentage of the gross profits, which probably still goes on today, I would imagine. So when a movie is coming out, he's going to huck it. He's going to talk it up. But if the movie comes out and is completely derided by critics, he will jump right on that bandwagon. And that's exactly what he did, where he called this movie lifeless. He had some pretty bad things to say about it in the years after, to the point where Mark L. Lester on the commentary, which I watched for this, said that King was on set every day. And it was King's idea to have Drew Barrymore's hair blow every single time she was going to cause a fire. All of these ideas were his. And Lester was like, well, the one movie you did was Maximum Overdrive. Why are you criticizing what we're doing with your material?
Now I know where James Cameron gets his ideas for loving or hating a film that he's getting producing right. points on. Shit, he does Terminator. I'm surprised. Like, I did not think there was that kind of acrimony going on throughout this, because I've always thought this was one of those King films that was more loved than other ones. That was my memory of it as someone who thought he had seen this film and realized that he hadn't, but I always thought this was well regarded. Maybe it's just because of Drew Barrymore love.
Yeah, this was 2 years after E.T. She was on top of the world. A couple years before this movie had come out. I mean, I had a book and record that she narrated about E.T., like with her head kind of leaning on him. And she really had that cute girl mentality. And we talked about this when we talked about Cat's Eye. This was Dino's main get. Dino wanted Drew Barrymore for these films. And it was his idea to put her in this role. And you know what? On paper, that should work. On paper, you take this precocious little girl, this girl who we saw ball her eyes out over an alien dying. Everybody loved her at this point, and you make her dangerous. That should work.
Should, absolutely. I mean, a little ahead of its time, but it absolutely should work. With the names attached from the mind of Stephen King, you'd think it'd be an easy hit. However, I didn't realize until it was the first name that came up, and even I went, oh, Jesus Christ. Dino's gonna Dino. So I guess see where stuff went wrong. Because I see Dino De Laurentiis, the first thing I think is, oh, he promised a lot and then pulled the rug out from under them as they were getting ready to shoot, because that's what he does. I'm going to give you all this money. No, I'm going to use the money for myself. I mean, that's just Dino.
He did pump some into this, though. And you know what? We're going to talk about when we get into the film, but the effects in this, you're not going to have computer effects. This is real fire being done. This is all real fire stunts. So at least it's practical. And Adam, you always gravitate to practical, right?
I do. I think it matters. I think it shows up. And yeah, when I was reading that, I was surprised. And I was reading something with people that had worked on the effects, and that a lot of effort, especially when it got into throwing fireballs, that they wanted to do it practically. And I'll admire that. I always will.
All right. But do we admire this movie? Let's jump into this. We start off, we get this little jazzy tambourine dream score with fire going on in the background. It's almost like Lethal Weapon 3's credits that we talked about a few weeks ago. This tambourine dream score. Now, I like some of their stuff, but when they were asked to do a score for this, what they did was they just sent some of their music and said, have fun with this, do whatever it is you want. And you know what? I like Tambourine Dream, but I don't think the score fits this film that well.
Nope, this score should have gone up in smoke the moment they submitted it. It's horrible.
It definitely feels like somebody who didn't even see the film, and they just gave them a set of music to go do whatever you want with it.
Feel like it's a really good score for a different project. This is some weird psychosexual thriller type of score that's playing right off the bat, and that's uncomfortable, being that I know what this movie is. Put it in Twin Peaks, put it in a lot of other stuff, but it doesn't belong here. It's not that it's bad, but it sure doesn't belong in this.
Adam, you said this is the first time you watched this?
I know I've seen scenes from it, But yeah, to watch this film, this is it.
I feel like this is the score they composed for Legend, and then someone just recycled it. Yeah. It should belong in that or Near Dark, something that's much more stylish and fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
Was this your first time watching this film?
Yeah, I've never seen this before.
Okay. Yeah, this was something that when I was growing up, on the weekends, instead of going out and partying, I was at home watching movies. And this was on like one Friday night, I believe. It might have been during the summer. It was back to back. I watched, wow, very coincidentally, I watched it back to back with The Thing for the very first time. And I had taped them off HBO. And I would watch this quite a bit as a kid or as a teenager. We open up, we have David Keith and Drew Barrymore. They're making their way through a crowd of people as Charlie says that she's tired and wants to stop as she's scared. Now let's talk about our stars here. As I mentioned, Drew Barrymore was the biggest star, having been in the biggest film of all time up to this point. But this David Keith, man, he's kind of in over his head. He was a last-minute replacement, and I'm not sure if a Kurt Russell or some of the other names that were attached could have helped with this character, but him as the father of the star of this movie really leads nowhere, and he's not very good here.
We're right back to the typical boring Stephen King protagonist, and it's made worse because we went back to Salem's Lot of we're going to get an actor who blows. The only other thing I've seen this guy in was in Officer and a Gentleman.
Yep.
Well, I shouldn't say the only thing, because speaking of which, he was in Daredevil for a little bit. Did they want Keith David and got the wrong guy?
How do you have two stars with the exact same first names just reversed? It's weird.
See, I don't mix up David Keith and Keith David. I mix up Keith David and Robert Wool, because I'm watching the beginning of this and I'm like, wait a minute. He did this a couple years before. He's asking about a 6-foot bat in Gotham. Wait, no, that's not Robert Wool. But goddamn, does he look like I'm going to be this guy. I think he actually does a pretty decent job.
Wow.
I think he might be one of the first decent parents we've seen throughout any of these Stephen King movies so far. I think he actually cares about his daughter. And yeah, I think he's serviceable with what we, and I guess that's the compliment, but I think he's serviceable for what he's given.
I think the perfect choice was the one that Carpenter had in mind, Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah, that was Carpenter's choice. Hmm.
You know what? For an everyman, if you're doing an everyman in the place that this goes, I could absolutely see that. But Richard Dreyfuss doesn't score the wife. Oh, God. Keith David does.
Let's hope not. All right. Let's talk about Drew. We mentioned in Cat's Eye, we thought she was pretty decent in that. I think she's okay here. I remember her being a huge part of the marketing for this film. You know, she's front and center in the poster. You have fires going on around her. But as I mentioned, you see the cutest star of the time of E.T. setting fires. You should be prepared to be terrified of her, but I'm not sure the material gives her the best things to work with. However, there are times when she kind of comes off as too whiny. I don't know. I'm back and forth on her, but I'm leaning more towards bad.
I think this just comes down to a director who doesn't know how to work with kids. Because I think she's inconsistent and misdirected through a lot of this. I'm never scared of her. But there's also points where I think she's too innocuous. I don't feel like there's any kind of balance at all. And I don't blame Drew Barrymore, because I've seen her be much better than this. But they needed it. This is one of those times where if Spielberg was going to do a King movie, I feel like this is one property he actually would have fit.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's fine. I don't think she steals the show like she does in E.T., but I also don't like E.T.
So you don't really like her here, or do you? You think she's okay?
Yeah, I think she's fine. To Matt's point, I don't think she's served by the directing. I think a director has no idea what to do with a kid on set. I also don't think at this time the industry knew what to do with kids on set, because I can't imagine knowing that the times and hours and the bullshit that they put kids through and her being a legacy because she had family already in the industry. I can't imagine, and I would be probably horrified to know the hours and shit that she was put through on set as a little girl. So I think she's fine. I don't know what you could do better in this age back in the 80s. You up it 10, 15, 20 years, obviously things have changed. But yeah, I think she does a decent enough job.
Most punishing thing of all was I'm sure she had to read all of King's first drafts.
So we see the two, they're getting pursued by another car as guys in suits pursue them, and they get inside a taxi. The car takes off and the driver says that he can't go to the airport, but Andy gives the driver what he thinks is a $500 bill and tells him to drive. All right, so let's talk about the skills that Andy has here. In the book, it is called a push, and the more he pushes, the more it hurts his head.
How many times can you rename The Shine?
Well, this isn't The Shine, dude. He's pushing people to do his bidding.
Okay, The Force, then. The push the Force. Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, that's just it. In this movie, it comes off as the Force. In the book, there are different things going on. Like, for example, there's a ricochet effect. He calls it the ricochet, and it only happens one or two times. But in that instance, what happens is if he pushes too hard, it causes the other person's brain to kind of just go crazy. And the person that he's trying to push goes absolutely nuts. And so they have literally no brain power left. They don't play with that here. Like you said, Matt, it comes off as the Force. And you got this stupid sound effect in the background every time he uses it. Like, it's something that's straight out of something that me and Adam would have watched in $6 Million Man or Wonder Woman at that time. I don't really like the way it comes off in the film. I think in the book it's done better because there are different sound effects.
You know what? Because I did not expect this. And I didn't remember any of this. So I'm kind of surprised. And I like it. To Matt's point, I can't believe we're redoing The Shine, or at least that kind of stuff. We're doing telepathy. We're doing King Gonna King. But I had no idea. My memory of this was so minimal. I didn't remember a father. I didn't remember that he had powers. And the basic, almost like Steve Rogers-ness of, we're going to volunteer ourselves for testing for this and that. I fucking love that idea. So where this is starting out and going, it has me pretty damn hooked and intrigued.
Well, yeah, this is where I get the X-Men connection, because this is Weapon X.
Very much so.
In a lot of ways, and it's an interesting premise. My problem with this movie is not the conceit. I think this is one of the, you ask me, this actually warranted a remake, because I like this concept. I just don't like how it's executed. The greater part of that is I read the Dark Phoenix saga, so I know how this ends. Not in the movies, because they tried that twice and they fucked up both times.
So Andy falls asleep, and we're giving a bit of background on where they came from. We hear Lot 6 for the first time, and we're told that it is a hallucinogenic, and they're not sure what the experiments are going to cause. And this, unsurprisingly, is straight from the book. Periodically, he will go back and he will do flashbacks to where they came from in the certain chapters. So we're going from current to past. And we're also hearing that the experiments are not being done by the Shop, which is a big King entity. If you go back and look at a lot of his books, we'll talk about the Shop again. Hell, we talked about the Shop when we did The Lawnmower Man. It's the same thing. The movie, not the story itself.
I was blown away here in the Shop, though, when that name got dropped. I got to be that Leo meme of being like, ooh, ooh. You know, I was like, I get it.
Nice. But when you talk about the Shop and you talk about these guys in black suits, I mean, 10 years later, the X-Files would run with this, right, Matt? This is a new concept at the time, but since then, we've seen this done a lot, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, this goes back to the 50s with the Men in Black, the CIA, these type of mysterious government entities. That would not just X-Files, Men in Black would run with this. Mm-hmm. They would literally take the name and do something cool with it.
And this is when we see the intro of Andy to Vicky, played by Heather Locklear, who was probably on set, what, maybe a day, if that?
It was probably the second most famous person in this.
Yeah.
Was Dynasty on around this time?
Yeah, Dynasty. I forget what other
TV. Yeah, she was TV.
TJ Hooker.
TV, TJ Hooker. This is her first film.
Yeah, TJ Hooker, the show that made her famous and people's dicks crooked.
We see the injection of Lot 6 as Andy asks when he's going to start to shrink. He's then reassured that he will be just fine. We hear voices in the background, and Vicky says that Andy told her that her hair is beautiful, though he actually just thought it. So here's when we start realizing that he can do more than he did before the injection of the drug.
Yeah, it's the Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, exactly. We're seeing some results of the experiments as Andy wakes up. They're dropped off at the airport as the Shop is in full pursuit. They're hearing the idea of him pushing people and that it is actually giving his brain hemorrhages. Charlie tells Andy that it's not right to steal, and then she says that the big bad is what she did to her mommy. So we know at this point that she actually killed her mom. Although, when we see it, she just sets a couple oven mitts on fire.
Yeah, it's the Obi-Wan rule from a certain point of view.
Exactly. Andy gets another headache as Charlie says, poor daddy. And we're seeing a domestic issue happen as a guy tells his girlfriend to stop bugging him. As we get this incredible Hulk TV show noise every time Andy uses his pushing powers to get coins out of a payphone.
It's just funny you say that, because I could actually see Bill Bixby in this main role.
Oh, that's a good call. Yeah. I could see anybody else but David Keith. I'll just say that. They emerge as the domestic issue is continuing, and Charlie ends up setting the guy's shoes on fire. What I like about this, again, this is directly from the book. Adam, when we watch movies like this, and we talk about it with comic book films too, you got to start small, right?
You do. And I like that this shows something in her right away. It it's informing that, plain and simple, she doesn't like bullies, doesn't like this kind of person. I mean, there's a goodness in her, just innate, that she doesn't like this shit. You could tell it's going to come back in something probably fairly similar, but I like this kind of development. I think it's a smart way to do it.
Wait. A Stephen King movie that's critical of bullies? this is progressive.
Charlie tells Andy that it just happened, and Andy says that this wasn't like before, as if she continued, she could have set his face and hair on fire, and then begs her to stop thinking about what she did to her mom. Andy says that they have to go on like Indians. Oh, more on Indians here in a bit.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I bet the
Indians
burned this fucker to the ground.
Oh, my God. We see the shop pull up to the airport as Charlie and Andy walk across a bridge. Charlie says that she feels like the shop is near, so they hide behind a tree. They fall down a hill and almost get run over by a truck. Andy tells Charlie that he'll never die on her because she's all he has in his world. And what I like about this, King wrote this book basically about what would happen if his daughter could do stuff like this, like could be this particular type of character. And I do like the father-daughter relationship. I think that's pulled off pretty well, even if one of the actors is better than the other.
Yeah, I feel like they're father-daughter. I like the connection. I think it works. Now, in a movie like this, when somebody says, I'm always going to be here for you, I'm never going to die on you, you might as well start circling the crows or put a timer up in the corner at that point. But I like the relationship of these two. I do.
Matt, do you have any connection to these two as far as your relationship goes?
On the page, yes. In performance, no.
They go to a motel, and Charlie is once again fretting about burning the guy from earlier. We get another flashback to Andy teaching Charlie how to pull back her powers, which she's having a hard time doing. Charlie refuses to go to bed, and in protest sets Vicky's oven mitts on fire, and Andy once again yells that she has to control her power. And this is the stuff when David Keith has to yell like this. I'm like, oh my God. Not good. We then get another flashback, this time of Andy coming home and finding Vicky dead in a closet. And, of course, this is Keith once again playing grief, and he can't do that well either. So, again, we have to kill the mom off.
Yeah, the Disney rule comes into effect here.
Mm-hmm.
This shocked me. One, I didn't know Locklear was in this film. And clearly, for good reason, she's not in it long. Damn, they literally folded her up and put her in a closet. This blew me away. But it's where I started to get confused. I mean, Charlie's got guilt. I mean, she doesn't kill her. She's being hunted, and they kill mom. This was an escalation I didn't see coming.
Andy runs and tries finding Charlie, which he does while she's getting attacked by two men from the shop. He forces one to drop his gun and then tells the other to bring Charlie to him. He then makes them both think that they're blind before telling the maid that she won't remember any of this and then driving off. That's pretty scary to me. If somebody can influence you to be blind, that's really scary.
I'm waiting for a scanner's moment. I'm thinking he's going to pop someone's head.
Wow. We cut to
not with his budget.
We cut to the shop, located in Virginia, as Martin Sheen, making a return to the Stephen King retro, pulls up on his bike and takes a meeting with Native American Rainbird, played by George C. Scott.
Oh.
All right.
There's two things we got to talk about.
Yeah, go ahead.
Martin Sheen was a last-minute replacement for Burt Lancaster.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the wrong kind of over-the-top in this. Dead Zone, he played it right. This is the opposite. The red elephant in the room. This is as insensitive as casting John Wayne to play Genghis Khan. I'm so glad we live in a different time because, holy shit, Hollywood would be burnt to the ground if this happened now.
My God. Yeah, just put a ponytail on him and call him Native American. This really feels like what it is, which is Dino wanted George C. Scott really bad. But once he eventually finally agreed to do it, I believe he took like $1 million paycheck or something to do it for just a set of days. They didn't have anywhere to put him. So here he is as this assassin. And I like him in the role of an assassin. Him in the role of a Native American assassin doesn't work. And he is a huge part of the book. This is one thing they did scale down, is he has this strange relationship with Charlie, which we'll talk about. And I don't find him to be menacing here. Not only is he miscast, I just don't think he's the right fit for a role. But they got this guy who, say what you will about this cast, it is loaded with Oscar winners. He's just not right for this role.
Oh, wow. Him as a character? Cool. Him as a character actor? Cool. Him as an Indian? This is so offensive, it might as well be a Tyler Sheridan show. I mean, this is as bad as casting a Mexican as the crying Indian and lying about it for 30 years. This is fucking... I mean, Garrett, I almost want you to have Jen explain this to her and just to film her reaction.
Oh my God.
She'd break shit. She would break shit in your home.
Yeah, she did not like this.
If you're going to include him and you need to, just don't do this. Now, agree, it was the 80s, so you don't have the, I mean, you have the knowledge, but you don't have the outrage, real and manufactured, that you have nowadays. But this is just wrong to do. If you're going to do it, then you take off the Native American portion of it.
I mean, who funded this? Daniel Snyder?
Somebody just as sensitive.
I don't even know if he owned that team in the 80s.
No, he didn't. It was just a terrible joke. Hollister, who is what Martin Sheen's playing, asks if their problem in Venice is solved, which he's told it is, as Dr. Wanless shows up and tells them that they need to expunge the lives of Andy and Charlie as they pose a threat to the entire nation. They talk about the origins of Lot 6, and it is the cause of mental domination that made Andy and Charlie. So I like this doctor character. I do, because this girl can cause a nuclear war. We talked about nuclear war last week when we talked about the dead zone, but this girl could really literally set the world on fire. They're trying to prevent that, but for some reason, this Hollister character doesn't want to do that, and that is a problem in the book as well. The motivations are not really clearly defined, except in Rainbird's case, which we'll talk about here in a bit, but everything's all jumbled because they're including all these characters from the book. They just don't have clear motivation.
I don't understand what is happening, period, because they're trying to cover this up. But where's the inherent danger in these two being exposed as having ability? What is the threat they're trying to avert exactly? Dead Zone makes it clear once that's revealed about nuclear war. You have Carrie, obviously there's escalation there. I don't understand what the big deal is.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it was just the experiment worked on them and these people want them back to keep testing or to keep going down that route. Maybe I'm assuming that, but I don't have the issue. The experiment worked, and then they fathered a child, and that child now has powers, and the shop wants the people with the powers back.
Wanless asks, what if Andy's control over his daughter has weakened? And then Hollister says that Charlie is just a little girl, but Wanless asks, what happens if she becomes an adolescent and becomes capable of causing a nuclear explosion?
That it's called Carrie.
Hollister asks if they can train her, but Wanless just wants her exterminated. We then cut to Charlie and Andy as they head someplace to stay, and Andy says that if they can send some letters to a strong newspaper, maybe they'll cause the shop to lay off them for a while.
Oh, yeah, because it came out at a time where the press actually had power.
Mm-hmm. They hitch a ride with a nice old man, Art Carney, here, telling him that they're headed to Tennessee, and the man tells them that he'll get them at least 10 miles closer to Knoxville. We see some guys from the shop changing a tire as Andy and Charlie just ride right on by. See, that's the thing about these shop guys. They come off as almost bumbling.
Yeah, they're not imposing. Like, if this was the Men in Black, aliens would have blown us off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
These guys are like a pratfall away from being the Three Stooges.
Pretty much. The man offers them to stop by his place for his wife's cooking, and then he says that he's always wanted a little girl for himself. They pull up to his house as he sings them a song, and we have Louise Fletcher here, a few years removed from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Here she is, playing second fiddle to Art Carney in a Stephen King film.
Were they trying to assemble the Avengers for a movie that didn't deserve this level of talent? This is the biggest cast of a King property up to this point when you look at the collectiveness.
Yeah.
For the most inferior material.
I know.
It's like you got all these people, and then you got David Keith as the lead. It doesn't add up.
Irv tells Norma about their new company as Charlie starts chasing the chickens for a little bit. They sit down to eat, and Charlie is obviously very starved, and she lets loose that her mom used to, she means always says, so some of the stories getting leaked out here. This makes Irv suspicious, and he asks Andy if he wants a beer. He then asks Andy if the cops are after them, and if he snatched Charlie from her mother. Andy then tells Irv about the shop, which is the Department of Science Intelligence, and he mentions the experiment that they were a part of, and that they are trying to use the two of them to relaunch the Lot 6 program. So a lot gets conveyed here, and one thing I'll say, this movie is almost 2 hours. We talk about time a lot when we talk about these films, but Matt, did you feel this?
Yes, my legs were numb by the point. Lot 6 is what I needed to inject into my lower thigh so I could shut up and turn off the TV. Because if I wasn't obligated to watch this movie, I would have turned it off because I was bored to tears up to this point.
I am actually enjoying this ride that we're going on.
Yeah. I'm more with Adam here. I like it. I think it's just because I like Barrymore so much, you know? And like, I'm going with the movie that's going at. But to Matt's point, the pace is really off, and it's by an amateur director who really doesn't have any idea how to pace a film, and it hurts it in that way. But I'm still going along with it because I like Drew.
I'm waiting for this movie to actually kick into some kind of gear. I want to know what the end game is of the shop. Are they trying to weaponize Lot 6 for their own private army? What's the goal?
It's at this point that the shop pulls up to the house and the room starts rising in temperature. And as you guys have mentioned, she must have the shine as she sees them coming up the dirt road.
Yeah, pyrokinesis and telepathy are not the same thing.
Yeah. Charlie tells Irv that he doesn't need his gun as they walk out to confront the agents approaching the house. But when they keep pushing, Charlie lets loose with her powers. She starts heating up as Irv is shot, and this causes Charlie to set all of them on fire. One gets his arm caught on fire, Kane style. And then one gets completely charred as she makes the cars explode as well.
It's about as unconvincing as Unforgiven 1998, where it was so obviously a prop arm that was covered
in goo,
whatever.
Yeah,
fire. It's like the same thing here, where you could almost see the DP holding out a lighter so this guy could be infernalized.
Well, we know how Matt feels about this scene. I kind of like this scene.
I'd like to flip from drama to action. I feel like we were getting some more of a drama movie build up, and then it's just, yeah, Charlie's gonna let herself. I'm digging the action. I needed something like this to go on. To Matt's point, yeah, you can see the seams, but for this kind of budget and this type of year, I'm glad we're getting practicals. I think it looks all right.
I'm just frustrated that this movie feels, and I can't speak to the book, this feels, of all the adaptations up to this point, this feels the most homogenized of other things that King has already done. You know, there's elements of Carrie, there's elements of The Shining, there's even elements of Salem's Lot with the random encounters and the abundance of characters. The Dead Zone, I draw the comparison because of how this gift can also be looked at as a curse. I don't feel like there's a unique justification of this material on King's part.
As somebody who has just read the book, I will say, up to this point, it was my least favorite read. Well, maybe Dr. Sleep. But you're absolutely right. It takes from a lot of what he's already done. And The Dead Zone last week felt so fresh. But one thing I will say is, especially in the last few weeks, you know, we got The Stand, which had elements of horror, but it wasn't really a horror novel. We have The Dead Zone, we have this. At this point, King is known as the master of horror, but we have all sci-fi themes going on here, and I did not remember that coming in. Now, we are going to get Cujo here in a few weeks, but Adam, it's more of a sci-fi film, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely more of a sci-fi than a horror or some of that other aspect. Yeah, the point getting brought up at the beginning about X-Men is pretty dead on. This is New Mutants, you know? This is the beginning of Gene. That's kind of what we're looking at here. Don't you dare. I mean, it's that kind of sci-fi film instead, which, I mean, for being the master of horror, I'm sorry, a lot of King's books aren't fucking horrific. Especially a lot of his successful adaptations are more along the line of this kind of sci-fi stuff.
I don't know, some of those lengths are pretty scary.
So are the lengths we got to go to watch some of these.
Charlie then apologizes to her dad for what she did. Irv tells Andy about the Jeep that he has, and he says that it's all theirs if they want it, and Norma urges them to take the help and get the hell away. They pull up to a lake, they walk across a bridge, and Andy hopes that the key is still there so they can set up shop there. Andy says that the shop still wants to capture them, but they're going to have to figure out another way of doing it. Andy then tells Charlie that they can live normal lives after the letters are written. We then cut to Rainbird. He takes someone out using a chop to the nose as Andy and Charlie pull up in the small town. Matt, we talked about George C. Scott when we talked about Exorcist 3. We joked at that time that we were going to get to this eventually. Is Scott even good here?
He's very disconnected. I don't know if he had some bills to pay, but this is what actors at the back nine of their career do. He still had miles left in that tank, but yeah, he's not good. He's not good here.
Adam, as somebody who did not watch Exorcist 3 with us when we watched it, how do you feel George C. Scott is here?
Oh, man. I think George C. Scott is Marlon Brando-ing his way through a lot of this film.
Oh, that's a perfect comparison.
That's a great comparison.
Yep.
But this is this era of George C. Scott. I think this is when he's just like, I got a mortgage to pay. He's here.
And he didn't even have a fun time on this movie either, because if you notice at the beginning, opening scenes that we see him in, he's got a contact in, right? He's got a contact lens in. A few weeks into production, that thing started infecting his eye. So if you notice, by the end, he's wearing an eye patch because he was like, fuck it, I'm not going to wear that goddamn eye contact anymore.
I read that and it made me laugh so much. God.
So Charlie and Andy, they're snitched out by an old lady, and Rainbird says that he himself will bring them there. He says that he'll do it as long as he can have her. Now, this relationship is very strange, Rainbird and Charlie. In the book, it's implied that it's not a pedophilic relationship. It's not that kind of thing. I think what he gets off on is the fact that he's going to befriend her and then take her out. He's in pursuit of the kill is what he's doing. But there are scenes in that book and there are scenes in this movie, such as later on when he puts his hand on Charlie's leg, stuff like that. I think King, in retrospect, wanted to make it a lecherous relationship and make us really hate Rainbird. But I don't know. It just feels weird.
Yeah, he tried to big bad wolf him.
Yes, that's a good comparison.
But it's the Into the Woods version where it borders on pedophilia.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a little too creepy. I get that he's trying to be the inverse of that other grandfatherly figure that we just saw. So I get what he's doing, but I don't think we've had enough of Charlie. If she was with mother instead of father, I think you would have a fatherly figure. So in here, it's redundant and it just doesn't work well enough as they think it does.
Rainbow says that they're going to be close because, as he says, inside her is the power of the gods. We cut to Charlie learning how to fish as Rainbow takes out a postal worker. We then see Rainbow load up his gun with some kind of poison dart as he climbs into a tree and waits.
This shit's so ridiculous. They might as well have given him a fucking blowgun.
Again, it's from the book. Andy says that they're headed to the offices of the New York Times, and Charlie cries and says that this is never going to be over. She then swears that she's never going to hurt another person for the rest of her life. And this is when I think Drew kind of comes off as a little whiny.
I think she comes across as a child.
Yeah.
But she is. I mean, she's not 13. She's supposed to be like 10, eight. 9, something like that.
8.
Eight. So yeah, I mean, she's not a 13, 15-year-old girl.
They head outside the house as Rainbird shoots Charlie and then takes out Andy. We then see guys in hazmat suits take the two of them away.
T-suits? I could not help but think when we see the trank darts and I'm like, these guys show up and I'm like, phone, huh? I mean, we got full-blown ET in these suits.
Andy wakes up and doesn't want to be acquainted with the shop members in his room as he just wants to see Charlie. But Dr. Pinchot tells him that he's just making sure Andy is treated well here at the shop. We then cut to Charlie. She makes her way around her room, which is weird. This is a weird scene because, Matt, we talked about what the director's trying to do. For some reason, he has this long-ass tracking shot of her inside this room.
Yeah, and you use that to either distort perception or it should transition into like a flashback of some kind. Exactly. But it doesn't. It does neither, so it comes off as him just trying to be artistic to a movie that really has no... I'm going to say this about a movie called Firestarter. There's no flair to it. Might as well just have Martin Sheen yell woo every time he enters into a scene.
Oh, my God. Hollister shows up with some cocoa. He tells Charlie that he's been looking forward to meeting her for a long time as he thinks of her as his own daughter. Charlie calls Hollister out on his lies and tells him to go to hell. He says that she's here because he's interested in her ability and she would be doing this country a big favor if she cooperated. But Charlie says that she swore she'd never set another fire her entire life, and Hollister assures her that they're going to be pals. She stops her powers from overheating the cocoa as the shop forces Andy to take some pills. Charlie also just turns down some toys that she's offered. It seems like this entire movie is being told in montage, doesn't it?
It does. Like, I felt like we've been kind of slow jogging our way through. And once we get here, I feel like we just almost stop and just barely are plodding along here. It's kind of confused on how it wants to get to the third act of this film.
And now it really slows down. It's the Green Mile and it feels about as long as that.
We then see Rainbird, disguised as John the janitor, walk in while Charlie is playing Atari. Do you guys know what game she's playing?
E.T.?
E.T., yes, sir.
She's the one.
I had E.T. I played it a lot as a kid, actually.
Yeah, you
I
were did one of too. The people who didn't bury it in the desert.
Yeah.
That game sucked.
Oh, it was so bad. But I remember being so excited when I got it for Christmas. Andy is talking to another guy from the shop as he gets another headache, and he tells the guy to put some ink in his water. Hollister requests them to up her medication as Rainbird assures him that before long, he'll have Charlie trusting him like a brother. We cut to Rainbird once again walking in Charlie's room, even though her room's not messy, and he says that he wishes he could help her see her father. She says that she won't do what they ask her to do in order to see her father, but the thunder and lightning sets the lights off, and she also tells John that she's not scared of his face because she's seen worse. I think this is when George C. Scott is bad, is when he's like, oh my God, I'm scared. This reminds me of my time in Nam. Like, this stuff is... It's so badly played.
Yeah, why? That's just because he runs into someone named Charlie?
Yeah. The lights turn off and Rainbird says that he's scared of the dark and he makes Charlie reassure him that they're okay. He talks about when he was captured by the Kong in Vietnam, which is what this predicament reminds him of. Oh my God. So you're comparing Nam to being in this shop room with this 8-year-old girl. Just stop it. He says he sometimes ate spiders and rice. And he says that it comes down to feeling like a rat in a trap. Charlie says that he can help her by sending her dad a message, which he agrees to do. Meanwhile, Andy swears he's not taking any more pills. Charlie tells Rainbird that she won't do her powers once again, and Rainbird says that he'll help her do the powers as she wants to do it, not as they want her to. The lights come back on, and Rainbird carries her to bed.
Message should have read second draft.
Oh my God. He tells her goodnight, and she responds with goodnight, Daddy. Oh boy. We cut to Charlie in a room with Pinchot, telling him to leave before she does what she's about to do. The room rises in temperature as the tape rolls, and she sets the wood chips on fire. Boys, I talked about it at the beginning here, but what do we feel about the way Drew Barrymore's hair blows right before setting the fires?
I understand it makes no sense. I get there's no logical reason for it. However, I've watched a shit ton of Marvel movies and other type of sci-fi films, so I go right along with it. Like, I understand there's no reason for it. I just don't care. I think you understand what's going on by it happening.
Yeah, in a movie that has George C. Scott playing a Native American, I can't nitpick. I have bigger problems. Much like the Men in Black, I have much bigger problems to worry about.
I'm with Adam here, where I don't see the sense in doing it, but I do see the dramatic sense in doing it, where it causes you to realize, oh shit, something's about to go down. She boils the water in the tub, which completely excites Hollister. Again, Martin Sheen being the wrong kind of over-the-top here, as opposed to last week. Pinchot says that they got her to do this by promising to let her see her father. And then Pinchot says this can't happen because of what can happen if they do see each other. They look in the room and see that Charlie has walked out, which amuses Rainbird. Charlie lays down and shares a moment with her dad. Hollister gives Andy more pills before telling Andy that his power has deteriorated a bit and he actually can't function stoned. Can any of us?
Don't tempt me, you have a good time.
Hollister tells Andy of a compound the shop has in Hawaii and that he'll try making that happen. Andy then gets up and spits out the pills. Rainbird takes Charlie to ride some horses, and she exclaims her frustration over the shop not living up to their word of her seeing her father after setting the fires. Adam, we have to set up these horses, right, for what happens at the end?
Yeah, it's the only reason they're here. And it still makes no sense. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Jesus, this. You know what? I was with this movie for the first half, but this is really dragging the film down for me, is this whole set of scenes here.
Yeah, this is the fucking Tatooine of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Charlie says that her power is stronger as she was able to pull back on it. We once again see Charlie in a room located in the shop as Hollister and everyone they look on. Wind blows through her hair again, and she's able to set a cinder-blocked wall on fire. She tells her power to back off, but it keeps going, even setting an ice block on fire and boiling the water inside. She proclaims that she wants to see her father once again, which Pinchot says will happen soon, but she proclaims that if they don't let her see her father, she will make something happen. Meanwhile, Andy starts changing channels with his mind, because we got to give him something to do here.
Remember Andy? He's in this film.
Yeah, exactly.
What is it with Stephen King and having guys named Andy stuck in prison?
Oh, jeez. Nice comparison, sir. I didn't think about that one. Pinchot says he's partially satisfied with the experiments, as Hollister asks Rainbird how she'd react if she found out who he really is. And this is like the book. In the book, these two do have a real confrontational relationship. So they're playing that a little bit here, but by the end, you really don't get a read on it.
Mm-mm.
So Rainbird says that his plan is to get John the friendly orderly to make her happy before striking her nose, breaking it, and sending fragments into her brain. We're going to do this to an 8-year-old girl. It is here where he proclaims that when he dies, he will take that power with him to the other world. Matt, this would have been so much more powerful had it been uttered by an actual Indian, wouldn't it?
Or if they did a second take.
Yeah, or if they did a second take. Hollister then tells Andy that he's being transported to Hawaii at 8, as Andy makes him think that he's holding a snake. Andy then wipes his bloody nose and tells Hollister to come along with his daughter. Charlie gets a note from her dad saying to meet him in the horse stable. She finds Rainbird and tells him of the note that she found. Rainbird says that he'll take her to the stable as another member of the shop comes to say he'll be the one to take her there. We see Rainbird enter the stable and climb into position. Charlie enters with the other guy from the shop and she tells him to scram. She starts causing the stable to heat up before telling it to back off. Rainbird then tells her to come up the ladder. So we had to get here somehow. We get to the final scene by introducing the staple. Adam, you kind of know where this is building to, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's much in the way of suspense as we get here towards the end. I think the first third to half, there was a lot of questions which way it could go. There's no surprises here.
Charlie's apprehensive, but she goes up the ladder anyway. But Andy enters as she does, and he tells her that they are really going away. He admits that he pushed him to do it, and Charlie asks if they can take John the orderly with them. But Andy tells her who John really is, which Rainbird admits to, and he says that he did it to save her life. He says that if she sets the stable on fire, she'll set fire to a lot of horses. She calls it off as he points a gun at Andy. He gives her his word that he'll protect her before Andy pushes Hollister to shoot at Rainbird. But Rainbird shoots Hollister instead. Andy then pushes Rainbird to jump, which he does. This was kind of funny when we see Georgie Scott just jump off this balcony. But he ends up shooting Andy. Rainbird asks her to look at him as he tells her that he loves her before firing a bullet that explodes in midair and he's being set on fire himself. So, I don't know, for 1984, this bullet exploding, not too bad, right?
No, it looks okay. It takes me a second, though, because how stupid are you to push him off, but you're not smart enough to, I don't know, take the gun away? You pushed him down and left him with his freaking gun.
You're so right.
I mean, Jesus. I need a little push and pull on this script here, fellas. But yeah, I mean, stopping this bullet, and that would have been something really cool to see back then.
Matt, you're just excited because we're at the end, right?
No, I'm pissed that he stole my fucking observation. This climax is ridiculously convoluted.
Andy then tells Charlie that a war is about to break out and that she needs to make it out any way she can, even if she has to burn it all down. You know what? I like this. I like the fact that he is the one who, not using his powers, but he pushes her to do what she's going to do. And we know at this point, she's going to unleash.
Yeah, this is when Charles Xavier tells Jean at the end of Apocalypse to unleash the Phoenix.
Yeah, this is what happens after the blood gets dumped on her at the prom.
Yep, exactly.
Oh, my God. You're right. Except it should be horse blood instead of pig blood.
It was amazing, though, because I didn't think this is where it was going to go. I remember bits and pieces. You know, I remember Drew and fire and all that. I didn't think we were going full-blown Carrie at the end of here. And I kind of like this decision that Charlie's just going to be like, fuck it, burn it down.
Well, yeah, just need more jazz hands.
Big difference between this and Carrie, though. Sissy Spacek wasn't wearing denim.
Let's also not forget Brian De Palma directed Carrie.
But I do like the fact that, you know, we're having the horses. They're neighing in the background. It's making this very uneasy. And from here on out, we are getting the end of Carrie, as you guys have mentioned, as now Charlie is pushed to the point of causing a ton of destruction. She kisses her dad goodbye and starts setting fire to things, but not before letting the horses out, which we got to do that. We at least got to get these horses to safety. She starts walking, and we're seeing fireballs take out Pinchot's golf cart, which would a golf cart get you out any quicker? I don't know.
Take what you can get.
Exactly. We see a spider walk of fire take out a bunch of shop members before deflecting bullets and sending more fireballs out. And I will say, I mean, this fire stunt in this house, pretty impressive.
For what this movie is, you got to remember 84, so 82, 83 being filmed. To pull off this much fire effect, to do so with what you were working with, is a pretty impressive thing to see.
We then see a helicopter approach, which she also takes out. She then blows up the entire shop, as well as a house. At the end of it all, she just utters, "For you, Daddy," as we fade from the destruction she caused. Matt, what do you feel about this final destruction here?
The effects are fine. I just don't like how the movie doesn't really have an ending. There's no real resolution.
Well, there is.
Yeah, but I was expecting her to get shot or something.
Okay, you're expecting her to die. Gotcha.
I mean, great, that would have been pretty extreme for especially this type of movie, but that's kind of what I was expecting, where she would die and the dad would snap.
Interesting. Adam, what do you feel about the final set of destruction here?
I like the way that it goes. There's some films we watch in so close proximity that I get really tired of the repetitiveness. And yes, all this is stuff we've seen before in King's work. You got to admit that. You got to say this. Yes, he literally redid the ending of Carrie here. But I like that it's done with this little girl. I like that it's her Jean Grey moment, her Phoenix rising. And I like the way that it's done. I think it's pretty powerful that she's all alone and she's just going to just wrath destruction around her.
We cut to Charlie apparently hitchhiking to the nice old couple from earlier. Norma gives her a hug, and we cut to her and Irv entering the New York Times as she tells her daddy that she loves him and credits roll on Firestarter. So here's your resolution. I guess she's going to just expose the shop.
I guess so, but who's to say that they won't deny the story?
Stay tuned next week.
Make news. You know what? It worked because it played back into something we'd seen before. And it is amazing that it used to be such an idealistic time that, you know, you take it to the press, you take it to the newspaper, and that's how you're going to expose the evil and corruption. Oh, God damn. Could we go back 40 years? Woodward and Bernstein, we need you.
And that does it for 1984's Firestarter. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Firestarter? Adam?
As the person who's been a little harsh on Stephen King throughout some of these movies, I didn't know what to expect going into this one. I remember the poster more than almost anything else. I mean, that Drew Barrymore image is pretty damn iconic as it gets. I was surprised how much of this is a drama going through, how much of it is a family drama, and I dug that. This is almost like the middle story of a longer play that's going on with the shop and all this other stuff. Problem is, it doesn't tie into all those other things. So on its own, you got strands really just left weaving in the wind. I think the performances kind of span the gamut. I think Drew is good until she's not. I think David Keith or Keith David is good sometimes and not. I think Scott is laughable. I actually enjoyed the return of Sheen. It just kind of made me, it almost made me think that the president has turned bad after Dead Zone, multiversal type of shit. I can't help but just go, man, it's so many redundancies. This is one of those movies that exists in the 80s, and it's kind of where it belongs. I know we're going to see some newer versions of it, but I don't know if you could do it again without just making it a flat-out superhero movie. It's not very horrific, but it's a decent little drama with some superhero elements in it. It's okay. It's a decent little background watch. It's not a bad King film. It's not one of his best, but God knows he's made a lot of crap. And after delving through Corn and so many other things, this, while maybe not a full-blown palate cleanser, it didn't offend. It sits there. It's a decent watch. It's a 6. I almost want to give it a 7, but there's enough gaps in here that I just can't. It's a 6. It's fine. Glad I watched it, but I don't see it going on again.
Wow. 6. That was more than I was expecting. Matt, I'm assuming you're not going that high.
No, but I'm also not going to go as low as you may expect, and that's just because we watched 11 Children of the Corn movies, so I know what hell looks like. I would call this like cinematic purgatory because it's not awful enough to enjoy, and it's not good enough for me to recommend. I think what is here is reprehensible on the part of George C. Scott playing a Native American. I think that is a point of damnation. But what's here, as I said earlier, it just feels too much like putting all of King's tropes in a blender rather than making something truly holistically original. And I also don't think the director was strong enough to really put a stamp on the material. If anything, Dino De Laurentiis should be the director of this movie based on everything Garrett espoused upon. Drew is fine, but I still think she's misdirected through a lot of it, which I think is the biggest problem. And I also don't feel like they don't go full Carrie because she doesn't become an outright villain at the end of the movie. So it doesn't fully, I guess, rip that off. But I also feel like a lot of the cast is wasted. I mean, you got Martin Sheen, George C. Scott, Heather Locklear, Art Carney, Fred Jones. You got a lot, some heavy hitters in this. And I don't feel like what they're given is worth them signing on the dotted line outside of, I'm sure, put some good revenue into their bank accounts. It's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but I did find it pretty laborious and not that fully fleshed out. Although they'll have two more chances to do this, although looking at what's to come, maybe this will be the high bar, question mark. I don't know. But it's not going to be a particularly high one to cross on that playground. So I'm giving this the trademark 4 on 10.
A 4 from Mr. Goudreau. I mentioned earlier that this, out of all my rereads of King's work, this was definitely my least favorite of the books. That being said, this film is a cardinal example adapting a book pretty much word for word and doing it in the least interesting way possible. For example, the scene of Drew Barrymore setting the Marines' feet on fire, that is expounded upon much better in the book than the way it's portrayed in the movie. In the movie, it just seems to go by. And that's a lot of what this film is. It's a lot of just going by. I think Drew does what she can, but at this point, she's an 8-year-old girl. She's coming off the most successful movie of all time. And if you take somebody like this, and I mentioned this earlier, you take someone like this, put them in a film like this that is supposedly done by the master of horror. It should be horrific when by the end she is just setting things on fire. You should fear her. You look at Sissy Spacek at the end of Carrie. I fear her because of the way she did her movements and everything else. Her body language really sold that. Here, they don't really do that. At the end, it's swing away as I go back to Signs, our Signs review. You're encouraging the main character to do the destruction, and you're not fearing her as much as rooting for her, which is a lot of what comic book movies are, quite frankly, as we've been talking about. But as far as this movie as a whole goes, I do think it's too long. I think they could have even narrowed it down a bit. I mean, we talked last week. The Dead Zone is almost too exponential for how good it was at deducting the episodic nature of that book and putting it in a 100-minute runtime. This is almost 2 hours. It does, especially at the scenes in the shop, it does feel like the 2 hours that it is, but at the same time, it's not a terrible watch. It's big problem is that it's boring. I just want them to get on with it because the performance by David Keith does nothing for me. Drew, I will take Matt's word on it and say that she was probably misdirected, but I don't think she's very good here either. George C. Scott, we've said our piece on. There's nobody here that I really care about. There's nobody here that I really want to see the story resolve. By the end, their stories are resolved. Rainbird's dead. Hollister's dead. And Charlie is still out there getting her word out there. We're going to talk more about this quote-unquote franchise next week, but as far as this movie is, as far as a standalone film, it's middle of the road. It's a 5 on 10. It's not terrible. And as Matt mentioned, after we've gone through all the Children of the Corn films, this was a breath of fresh air to see Drew Barrymore set things on fire. But 5 on 10, not bad. It's worth one watch. And then don't pick it up again. Speaking of don't pick it up again, next week we are talking about 2002's sci-fi original miniseries, Firestarter Rekindled, which does carry on with this storyline. Matt, we've talked sci-fi in the past. We talked about it with Marvel. We talked about it with Children of the Corn. What are you expecting next week when we review Firestarter Rekindled?
It'll reaffirm the belief of this is why you piss on fires before you go to bed. Because I am not expecting... I dread the words now, sci-fi movie. Mm-hmm. When we do any retrospective between Children of the Corn and Man-Thing, and from the director from Justin to Kelly, I don't know what good can come from this. And no, seeing the names Malcolm McDowell and Dennis Hopper do not sell me, because these are the same people who made Silent Hill 2 and Super Mario Brothers.
Those aren't good. Adam, what are you expecting next week, sir?
Oh boy, you know, Matt, the way Matt feels about sci-fi original movies, how I feel about Stephen King sequels, Stephen King remakes. I don't know. I get a bad feeling about this. This seems one of those somebody was trying to keep rights and threw something out. I don't wanna I don't wanna douse these flames out early, but I got a bad feeling about this, kid.
And then the week after that, we are doing the 2022 Zac Efron starring remake. Definitely things to say about that as well. But until next week, when we get to Firestarter Rekindled, show me a podcast or get the hell off my land. Thank you, boys.
Did we get the audio?
We got it.
We did!
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now, you've got to learn to control that. You've got to try real hard.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
What have you done to my father?
He's resting, and he's fine, just like you. And he knows you're all right, and he sends his love. And he wants you to cooperate with us.
You're a liar!
Now, what kind of talk is that from a nice little girl like you?
Go to hell!
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more. Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Holy Christ, I knew something was going to happen, but I had no idea.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
We do great things. We make things better here. We make people better. We make them stronger people like you.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies,
the Exorcist films, movies of the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
What more do you want from us? Why can't you just let us go?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
The world out there, they don't know how to handle your power.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I give you my real word.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I know you're tired, you're not quite sure where you are or why you're here, so I just want to ease your mind, Joe.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network. And all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
No one wants to hurt you or your daddy.
You liar! You're supposed to kill him, and I know it.
I'd advise you to do what my daughter says. I mean, you know why she's wanted.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You and me are going to be pals.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You are here because I'm very interested in this ability that you have.
Pyrokinesis.
Yes. All of us here are interested in that, and we want to see how far you can take it. Night, y'all.
The one movie you did was Maximum Overdrive. Why are you criticizing what we're doing with your material? Adam, anything to say about that?
Yeah, it makes me realize where I just completely stepped over myself. Now I know where James Cameron gets his ideas for loving or hating a film that he's getting producing right. Points on.
It definitely feels like somebody who didn't even see the film, and they just gave him a set of music to go do whatever you want with it. I'll save that talk for when we get to the remake for 2022 and Carpenter. Adam, how do you feel about this score?
This is one of those times where if Spielberg was going to do a King movie, I feel like this is one property he actually would have fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she's fine. I don't think she steals the show like she does in E.T., but I also don't like E.T. So,
What is wrong with you?
Yeah, what is wrong with you, dude? That is the one movie I will never review on this podcast because I cannot be objective with it. I will never.
Thank goodness. I like Spielberg and I like that movie.
Yeah, I will never, ever review that film for that reason.
It's fine. yeah. Send your arrows my way, people. Yeah. Sorry.
He's the guy who watched Jaws and said, it's just a shark.
Which we'll talk about. So you don't really like her here, or do you?
I'm waiting for this movie to actually kick into some kind of gear. I want to know what the end game is of the shop. Are they trying to weaponize Lot 6 for their own private army? What's the goal?
Adam, you're going to say something. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Moving on.
It's at this point that the shop... Irv tells Andy about the Jeep, and he has it. Irv tells Andy about the Jeep.
Yeah, he's not good. He's not good here.
Andy, Adam, as somebody who has Adam, as somebody who did not watch Exorcist 3 with us when we watched it, how do you feel George C. Scott is here?
Oh, man. I think George C. Scott is Marlon Brandoing his way through a lot of this film.
Oh, that's a perfect comparison.
That's a great comparison.
Yep.
But I find that for a lot of his work, I think he is one of the most overrated names.
God, yeah, have you seen Patton? He's great in Patton.
He has great films. And once you get through like four of those, the rest of his filmography is fucking crap.
All right. Well, since you challenged me, let me see if I can name more than five. Patton, Dr. Strangelove, Exorcist 3, The Changeling. Oh, shit. I might not get the five. Changeling. Oh, Anatomy of a Murder. That's five.
Mm.
The Hustler makes six.
Oh, The Hustler. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't think of The Hustler. Yeah, it's a good one. So it's, I mean, it's, sorry. I.
That's my Lot 6 right there.
But I do think that this is
my hands on fire.